Welcome everyone to today's internet seminar entitled The Charette Redevelopment by Design, which has been sponsored by the U.S. EPA's Conflict Prevention and Resolution Center. My name is Jean Bell and I work here in EPA in a Superfund program, and I'll be moderating today's session. Again, we're going to take just a minute or two to cover some basic housekeeping items to get a couple of last minute stragglers on the line before we officially turn things over to our hosts and our official presenters for today. Just a reminder, when you registered for today's session, you should have been directed to the seminar homepage, which had a complete description of the event, as well as a listing of the instructors, their bios, their photos, as well as contact information. You also had the opportunity to either access the slides online or download them in a variety of formats. That seminar homepage will continue to exist so that even after today's session, you can go back there to access the materials, check out the feedback form, or as well reach out to either the instructors or myself if you have follow-up questions or comments. Those of you who have joined us via phone lines, a final reminder, we do ask that you keep the phone on mute. Either use your own mute button or hit *6 to place your phone on mute. That'll help cut back on disruptive background noise. If you want to, at the appropriate times for questions, we'll invite you to take yourself off of mute, and you can do so by either unmuting or hitting *6 to unmute your line. So again, just hit *6 to mute for now, and at the appropriate times, we'll remind you how to take yourself off of mute to verbally ask questions and interact with the presenters. A final reminder, do not put this call on hold. Oftentimes there can be background music or commercials which will be disruptive, so just keep us on mute. If you do have to hang up, feel free to do so. You can dial back in without any disruption to the line. By now, everyone should have either downloaded the slides and should be looking at the title slide, slide number one. If you're looking at the slides online, you should have clicked the Go to Seminar or Go to Session icon and should be looking at slide number one of the presentation. Those of you who are viewing the slides online or streaming the audio, you'll see a number of orange icons above the slides that you can use to navigate through the materials. Our presenters will be indicating as they move to the next slide, and you can either use the numbered links which appear to the left of the slides to navigate to the appropriate item, or you can use the single arrow button pointing to the right to move forward one slide, the single arrow pointing to the left and moving backwards one slide. Another button of interest I'd like to point out there is a question mark icon. If you have your pop-up lockers disabled, and you want to be sure you do that, click the question mark icon. What that will do is actually open up a new window where you can submit an electronic comment or question to us at any point in time. You don't have to wait to the official Q&A break to do that. You can submit those comments or questions at any point, and at the appropriate time, I will read them to the instructors on your behalf. You can also use that same question mark icon to report any technical difficulties may be having. Those of you who are joining us on the phone lines, please keep yourself on mute. You'll want to hit *6 to mute your line or use your own mute button. Here's the call waiting button coming through. And if that doesn't silent out in a minute or two, I will globally mute all of the phone lines. So again, please hit *6 to mute your line. Just a reminder as well. We will be going through it at the appropriate times. We do have designated breaks to interact with the instructors and have questions asked. I'll give you instructions on how to take yourself off mute at that time. I will also read online questions at that point as well. The other thing to remind everybody, at the end of today's session, we're going to point you to one final slide, and that is the slide that's going to bring you to our feedback form, which the Conflict Prevention and Resolution Center would greatly appreciate your help with providing that feedback. So at the end of today's session, each one of you will be given the opportunity to fill out that feedback form and let them know what you thought of this training. If you're sharing the line or location after you submit feedback, the next person can click a link on the confirmation page and they can each supply their own feedback. We do ask you submit that feedback to ensure that we can continue to deliver free online information sessions like this. The other thing I'll point you to is a collection of additional resources which may be useful to you, and that is something that's also available on the seminar homepage. One final reminder that this entire session is being recorded and will be archived on the CLUIN session. Within approximately 2 weeks, you'll be able to find it on the CLUIN Training Archives page, or you can also choose to subscribe to our podcast in iTunes to receive the latest archive sessions for free as soon as they're available. So with that one final desperate plea to the individual who is not on mute to please hit *6 to mute your line, do not put this phone call on hold. And I'm going to segue over to Anna Abbey over here, who's joining me from the EPA's Conflict Prevention and Resolution Center. She can formally introduce today's session. I will also direct everyone to move past slide number two, the housekeeping slide, and to move on to slide number three. Anna?
Thank you very much, Jean. So now on slide three, I'd like to welcome you again to the Charette Redevelopment by Design webinar. My name is Anna Abbey, and I am one of seven experts in mediation and facilitation working in EPA's Conflict Prevention and Resolution Center, sponsor of today's webinar. I will be doing a quick introduction before handing it off to our presenters, and we'll at the end do a quick follow-up to discuss some further resources we have available. We have a large group participating today, and I'd like to thank you all for joining us. This training was designed specifically for use in Superfund redevelopment of lands, and the examples used today will reflect that, that the approach and methodology can be adapted to a wide array of projects. Slide 4. EPA values transparency, active stakeholder engagement, and collaboration. Last year, President Obama encouraged EPA's leadership to embrace participation, public involvement, and collaboration. This webinar will take a look at one of the many tools that can be used to reach that goal. Slide 5. The Conflict Prevention and Resolution Center, otherwise known as CPRC, serves EPA throughout the country. We find and retain mediators and facilitators, help you engage stakeholders, assess obstacles to agreement, design processes for collaborative decision-making, and provide training and coaching on conflict prevention and resolution topics. Generally speaking, our goal is to make it as easy as possible for EPA staff to get input from the public and reach agreement on difficult issues. Slide 6. We have two main vehicles for obtaining reliable experts, our conflict prevention and resolution contract and an intergovernmental agreement with the U.S. Institute for Environmental Conflict Resolution. Slide 7. For more information on what we do and what resources are available to you, you can call us at 202-564-2922 or come visit us on our website. Slide 8. You should also know that in your regions, there are Superfund redevelopment initiative coordinators who will be excellent resources for you as you think through this process. Slide 9. The two presenters today come from the environmental consulting firm E-Squared Incorporated. James Wilkinson is a senior associate with more than 10 years of experience in Superfund redevelopment with 30 site revitalization projects under his belt. Miranda Maupin is also a senior associate with E-Squared and manager of the community planning and design team. Ms. Maupin has over 11 years of experience in using community-based design charrette methods. Now I will hand things over to James and Miranda in order to give an overview and begin the training.
Thank you very much, Anna. Much appreciated. This is James Wilkinson here, and on behalf of both Miranda Maupin and myself, I'd like to also extend a warm welcome to everyone on today's webinar. Thank you very much for taking the time to join us. As you can see on slide 9 here, we're actually, we have a four-part webinar for you today. Next, we'll be jumping right into the basics of charrettes, providing a general introduction. In the second module, we'll then be looking at charrettes in the context of contaminated lands like Superfund sites. Third, we'll then be taking a closer look at what charrettes look like actually during different stages of the cleanup or remedial process. And then the final part of today's webinar, we'll be looking at how charrettes not only are a really strong land revitalization tool, but also work very well for community engagement and collaborative problem solving. So with that, let's get started. I think we can actually pass past slide 10 and go straight to slide 11. So we'll go right into module number 1. And before we actually focus on charrettes, I did want to take a second to talk about the big picture and EPA and land revitalization. And as part of EPA's overarching mission to protect human health and the environment, EPA National Cleanup Program goals also include engaging meaningfully with communities and supporting the return of formerly contaminated sites to long-term, sustainable, and productive use. And charrettes are a powerful way to achieve both of these goals. Next slide, slide 12. So what is a charrette? Well, a charrette is a collaborative planning and design workshop, one that brings together diverse stakeholders to plan for the future of neighborhoods, communities, and even cities and regions. Charrettes use dynamic visualization and mapping tools to develop innovative, sustainable plans for implementation. Charrettes enable public agencies, community organizations, developers, and others to address contentious, complex land use planning situations and build long-lasting relationships. We're often asked, what does the word actually mean? It's actually a French word, dates to the late 19th century, and it refers to a tradition in Paris where students, architecture and design students, used to put all of their final works, their final designs, and on a cart and had those designs delivered to their professors for final reviews. So today, the word charrette has probably, it's different from its original meaning, but it still is used to capture the atmosphere of energy, creativity, and visual focus inherent in the term's 19th century origin. Slide 13, just a brief history on charrettes. The quote on the slide here is actually from Andre Duany. He's a leading advocate for charrettes and also one of the founders of the Congress for New Urbanism. In terms of history on charrettes, really they've risen to prominence in the U.S. since the mid-1980s. in response to social, economic, environmental impacts from land use patterns that are often referred to as sprawl. A second reason is there's been a lot of interest in ensuring meaningful public participation in the planning of communities, and charrettes are very, very good at making that possible. Interest in charrettes has been supported by organizations and initiatives like the Congress for the New Urbanism, the Smart Growth Network, and the National Charrette Institute. I should also point out that charrettes work very well at different scales. They can work very well for individual development projects. So, for example, the new condo that's going in down the street, they may well use a charrette to think about how they're going to design and implement that project. But they also work very well at the city and neighborhood level, working on, for example, the revitalization of downtown business districts. And they're even used to help visualize the future of entire cities and regions for purposes like economic development and also for watershed and green infrastructure planning. Slide 14. Let's talk a little bit about the key elements of a charrette process. Before I actually refer to the slide, I did just want to make a couple other points. One up front is being that the term charrette can mean different things to different people. To some, it simply connotes a meeting in which people brainstorm and perhaps sketch ideas, whereas to others, their charrette process is synonymous with public involvement. The charrettes on which this webinar are based are distinguished by their intensive collaborative nature and by their holistic approach focused on feasible solutions. Now, the heart of a charrette process, which is the charrette itself, can be a single or multi-day event. They range in duration from 1 day to up to 5 days, and typically takes about 2 or 3 months of pre-charrette preparations prior to actually hosting the collaborative workshop. And then that's, of course, followed up by post-charrette planning and implementation. Charrette process costs typically ballpark are between $50,000 and $100,000, depending on a project's complexity, information and expertise needs, and duration. However, it might be helpful to keep in mind that much of these costs are upfront. The site and community information gathering and analysis and the stakeholder outreach, those activities which form the core of a charrette process need to be conducted at most contaminated lands. And the charrette process provides an opportunity to conduct remedial planning and cleanup in an intense, time-efficient way that's future-focused, providing EPA and other site stakeholders with the information needed to protect human health and the environment and support land revitalization. And in some cases, it's even possible that a charrette may help to speed up the cleanup process and or to reduce cleanup costs. So in terms of the slide in front of you, some of the key elements we kind of touched on in passing. One, that there's a mission to plan for any number of different scales, either at the site scale or the larger region. Two, community engagement and conflict resolution. Making sure that a wide range of folks are engaged and addressing conflict is a huge part of charrettes. And three, really the core of charrettes are these collaborative design and planning workshops. Slide 15. Here are three additional key elements just to mention. First up, that there's an interdisciplinary charrette team. These are the folks, the landscape architects, the land use planners, really the team of specialists that are brought together to work with stakeholders on the charrette process. Charrettes really emphasize visual and design aids like maps, as you see in the background of the slide here, to visualize future use opportunities. And they're very goal-oriented, so it's basically coming out of a charrette, you're looking at a primary outcome for both a feasible reuse plan or strategy, as well as an implementation strategy. So really trying to hit the ground running coming out of charrettes. Next slide. Just to briefly recap, there are three stages to a charrette process, or it's helpful to break it up into three, perhaps. Pre-charrette preparation, charrette itself, and then post-charrette. In pre-charrette, you're really focused on reaching out to people, making sure that you're building relationships, bringing everyone to the table to work together, and you're also gathering all the information you need. So looking at the site, looking at the community, and then analyzing that information and bringing it to the charrette itself. The charrette, as we talked about, is this collaborative event, collaborative planning and design workshop, brings all those stakeholders together to work together, and it's very goal-oriented, resulting in a feasible reuse plan. You may also sometimes hear other titles for the outcomes, like a reuse strategy or a reuse framework. And then lastly, but very important as well, is the post-charrette stage, focused on planning and implementation. This is the stage where it might be necessary to gather additional information, to pursue resources, and also to finalize everyone's responsibilities and next steps to actually make land revitalization happen. Next slide. I'd also like to emphasize that charrettes are a best practice because not only are they an effective land use planning tool for land revitalization, They're also an effective public involvement tool that enables collaborative problem solving and conflict resolution. Effective public involvement forms the foundation of all charrettes. Accordingly, as this slide is intended to illustrate, charrettes mesh well with EPA's public involvement program, EPA's mission being to protect human health and the environment. And to achieve that mission, EPA needs to continue to integrate meaningfully the knowledge and opinions of others into its decision-making processes. An effective public involvement can both improve the content of the agency's decisions and enhance the deliberative process. Public involvement also promotes democracy and civic engagement and builds public trust in government. And we'll talk a good deal more about public involvement, community engagement as part of the fourth module in today's webinar. Next slide. Let's talk a little bit as well at a very general level about charrette benefits of contaminated lands. So far, I've been talking about charrettes in general. You might see them down the street at a neighborhood development project, but what about at a Superfund site? Well, there's a set of benefits that charrettes can provide in this context. First, community engagement. Charrettes build relationships between EPA, between communities, and other key parties at contaminated sites. Second, enhanced decision-making. Charrettes yield information that leads to enhanced decision-making by EPA staff and local stakeholders throughout the remedial process. Third, realistic community expectations. Charrette's use of detailed, comprehensive information helps establish these community expectations for future land use opportunities. And finally, as we just talked about, charrettes are a powerful conflict resolution tool well-suited to environmental and land use conflicts. We turn to the next slide, slide 19. Several additional benefits just to highlight. First, focusing on the future. The charrettes provide a way to incorporate the past and present within the context of a forward-looking focus, enabling parties to move beyond the stigma of contamination and the blame game that's often common at contaminated lands. Next, time and cost efficiencies. Charrettes yield information that can reduce cleanup costs and timeframes. Third, institutional controls. Outcomes from charrettes can inform the selection of appropriate institutional controls. And on a related note, the last bullet there, charrettes engage key site parties and identify future site roles and responsibilities, ensuring protectiveness and the long-term stewardship of sites. I think if we move to the next slide, we'll actually have reached our first discussion slide. So, Jean, if we could open the floor to questions and comments, we'd love to interact with folks.
Absolutely. Just a reminder, those of you who are on the phone line, you are welcome to take yourself off of mute. Either hit the unmute button on your end or hit #6. You can feel free to go ahead and verbally speak up and ask the instructors a question. Anybody who's streaming the audio online, again, that question mark icon, at any point in time, you can click that and it'll open up a new window where you can type up comments or questions. We have just over 100 or so people that are live and on the line with us. So again, I would encourage you at any point, go ahead and type up those electronic comments or questions. I don't see any coming in just yet, but those of you on the phone line, does anyone have a comment or question for the instructors? Anybody who's joined me in the room today have a comment or question for the instructors? I mean, I have one, but I don't know if it's an appropriate time to ask it. I was wondering how someone might actually acquire support to host one of these. Is it something that someone working at a site would contract out, or is it something that the agency itself delivers?
Great question. Anna, is that one you'd like to handle, or would you like us to talk about it?
Well, it could go either way, but usually we do contract out these services, and we work with E-Squared a lot in the Superfund Redevelopment Initiative, as well as through the CPRC to do that.
Okay. Great.
And we do also, the final section of today's webinar does focus on resources, so we'll be circling back to talk about how resources can be allocated for working on charrettes.
Are you going to get into, this is Ellie Hale, are you going to get into the timing of when a charrette is most useful, like at what part of the Superfund process it can be most helpful?
And yes, that'll be in the third part of today's webinar. It's a great question. Yes, we'll be going into the different stages and trying to point out, I guess it might be more accurate to say trying to point out how they work at different stages as opposed to saying the some stages, basically we'll try and point out that you can use a charrette at each stage of the cleanup process and they can be quite helpful at each of those stages. So.
This is Wendy Tomey. Have charrettes been used widely throughout EPA?
Charrettes, could you repeat the question?
I'm just wondering how often we've used this tool. And the second part of my question is how, you know, if there's assistance in getting resources to do it. But I think you're going to cover that later.
Yes, we can cover the resources later. But charrettes are often part of a much longer reuse planning process. And in addition to CPRC, the Superfund Redevelopment Initiative has been promoting reuse planning assistance at Superfund sites for over 10 years now. So at this point, we have a lot of good examples of communities who've engaged in reuse planning at Superfund sites and to a very effective end, both in terms of informing EPA's process as well as facilitating the productive reuse of the site. So a charrette itself, you know, again, it can be thought of as a workshop, you know, 1 to 3 day workshop that can be incorporated in this much longer reuse planning process. And again, I think there are a number of examples where a workshop's been used or a charrette has been used to really galvanize the stakeholders around a single vision for the site. And I think it's been particularly helpful for EPA to, instead of hearing from multiple stakeholders and various perspectives on the future use, to finally have, you know, a unified vision for the future use that they can then use to inform the remedial process.
Thank you.
It also looks like we had a question that came in online. I'm just going to ask that very quickly from Austin, Texas. And they ask, how does one become qualified to effectively use the charrette process?
It's James Wilkinson here. I think I'll take a shot at that. I mean, I think there's one item to point out perhaps might be that typically in the reuse planning projects that we work on, state and federal agencies often serve as the sponsors for the projects, and they serve as resource members to the local communities who are hosting the charrette projects. But the state agencies or the federal agencies themselves do not actually lead the charrette process, that the bringing in a third party to kind of facilitate the process and bringing everyone together can be a fairly helpful component. In terms of specialized training, there's not a designated degree, you know, a master's in charrettes or a PhD in charrettes, but typically the folks who are putting them on tend to have backgrounds in landscape architecture and land use or environmental planning. Rand, anything you'd like to add to that?
Well, just that, yeah, I think it's, as James pointed out, ideally, the folks involved in the remedial process at EPA ideally are, you know, they may initiate the process and sort of sponsor the process in terms of inviting that kind of community engagement in the remedial process. But ideally, it's a third party, a neutral facilitator that's pulling the different stakeholders together, and that allows EPA to keep their remedial hat on and participate in the process as a resource, and then the facilitator of the charrette can then be this neutral party that's integrating all the ideas and ensuring that they align with the remedial process.
This is Louise in Albuquerque, New Mexico, and the National Charrette Institute also offers programs of training for charrette leadership, facilitation, and conflict resolution. Their central location is in Portland, Oregon.
Thank you. That's a very helpful addition. Yes, the NCI, as they're known, is a great resource, and their website has a lot of great information as well.
We can provide that link to everyone after the webinar.
Okay, with that, I don't see any other questions coming in online, and I think we've got a good break coming in from the phone, so I'm going to ask everyone to please place themselves back on mute. Again, either use your own mute button or hit *6, and then I guess I will turn things back over to our presenters following up on slide number 21. Great, thank you. So in module 1, James provided an overview of the charrette and reviewed how the charrette can be used to engage a community in planning for the future use of the site. In module 2, we'll look more specifically at how a charrette can be applied in the remedial process. So turning to slide 22,
As we discussed, the charrette process is a type of collaborative community-based planning that focuses on the future use of a specific site and involves the affected stakeholders. In pulling together the stakeholders, it can be helpful to think of the participants in three categories, and we've touched on this briefly. But the sponsor group typically includes the direct decision-making responsibilities regarding the site. So this might be EPA, local government, state agencies. The sponsor group is typically initiating and guiding the charrette process to support the decisions that they need to make at the site. The charrette participants can include community stakeholders that have a direct interest in the future use of the site. And finally, the charrette team includes the planning and design expertise responsible for facilitating the process and capturing the ideas generated in a set of plans. Depending on the site, the charrette team may include technical expertise such as economists, geologists, or ecologists. As the organizers of the design charrette bring the project's constituent members together, it's important to clearly define participants' responsibilities. In most charrette processes, project participants serve as an advisory capacity as part of a committee, making recommendations for consideration by EPA and local elected officials or departments. Charrette preparation meetings also need to define project participant roles, ground rules, and responsibilities. Design charrettes work best when they are consensus-based and when all project participants work together to identify reuse opportunities, address shared challenges, and build common ground around shared decisions that have outcomes acceptable to all participants. The process can be organized into three stages, as James touched on earlier: the pre-charrette preparation, the charrette itself, and the post-charrette planning and implementation. And we'll walk through each of these over the next few slides. Slide 23. The success of a charrette can depend largely on the degree of preparation. Key preparation steps include building support for the process, gathering information about the parties and the issues, identifying reuse goals and desired outcomes of the charrette, and gathering information about the site and surrounding context, and organizing it in a user-friendly format. Next, we'll walk through some examples of these preparation tasks. On slide 24, there's an example of future use goals. For the Plainwell paper site, the Plainwell paper mill site in Region 5, the stakeholders agreed on the following reuse goals: promote community gathering, provide residential, commercial, and recreational uses, attract visitors to Plainwell, enhance access to the Kalamazoo River, celebrate Plainwell paper mill's history, and ensure residents' health and safety. So these goals are not atypical of what we might see at a Superfund site, and they help to guide the charrette reuse ideas throughout the process and just provide general direction for participants moving forward through the process. Slide 25 outlines types of information that might be useful to gather in preparation for the charrette. This could include physical site characteristics such as wetlands, steep slopes, or streams. Site contamination and remediation could include site operable units, affected media and contaminants, as well as existing or anticipated remedial components and land use restrictions. Finally, a map of adjacent land uses and context of the site in the community can be helpful. On slide 26, additional information could include infrastructure and access, local land use regulations and community initiatives, and regional land use trends. So for example, a site might be adjacent to a regional greenway that's in its early planning stages, or the site could be located in a formal industrial area that is now becoming a mixed-use development zone. And these may be community initiatives that aren't readily apparent when you visit the site or when you look at some existing planning documents. But by gathering that information from the local government representatives, it can really change the opportunities that might be available at a site. Similarly, with regional land use trends, There may be growing sectors such as technology incubators or solar manufacturing in the region that could play an important role in the future use of the site. Slide 27 introduces the charrette itself. The charrette is a time for learning and collaborative problem solving. Building on the relationships established and information gathered during the pre-charrette meetings, the charrette can be an intense multi-day workshop that carries a reuse planning project from initial ideas to a reuse concept plan. The charrette agenda can include participant orientation, where you walk through the reuse goals and some of the information about the site and even a site tour. Time for sharing information about the site in the form of maps, data, or photos. Facilitating participant discussions about key issues and identifying information gaps and data needs. Slide 28 focuses on the bulk of the charrette, which is generating the use scenarios. Ideally, if there's time, participants close the charrette process by identifying implementation considerations and a set of follow-up steps that can be packaged as a reuse framework strategy. Slide 27 introduces the charrette. Slide 29 presents an example of sharing site information in a user-friendly format. Information gathered and analyzed during the pre-charrette stage is distilled into key findings by the charrette's consultant team and presented so participants can be starting from a shared knowledge base. Here in this image, the historic Sanborn maps for Quincy Smelter's Superfund site in Michigan are linked with current site conditions, providing charrette participants with opportunities to recognize the site's history and heritage and begin a discussion about prioritization. Slide 30 offers an example of reuse scenarios. Based on the information gathered and the reuse goals, the charrette team develops conceptual plans that identify future land use opportunities for different portions of a site. The team also highlights challenges and issues that need to be addressed in order for particular land uses to be located at the site. The illustrations on this slide are reuse scenarios developed for the American Creosote Works Superfund site in Louisville, Mississippi. The scenario on the left links potential site uses with the site's surroundings, which include a regional trail system and industrial land uses. The scenario on the right focuses on expanded opportunities for commercial and industrial development. Slide 31 offers examples of reuse framework strategies. Final charrette activities synthesize the site reuse options and focus the development of a site reuse framework. The site reuse framework includes a visual plan or series of maps which lay out the preferred reuse opportunities and key considerations for different parts of the site. Frameworks are flexible documents able to incorporate new information over time. The reuse frameworks on this slide are from the Chlor-Alkali Superfund site in Berlin, New Hampshire, and the Scoville Industrial Landfill in Waterbury, Connecticut. The framework for the Chlor-Alkali site focuses on commercial land uses and a regional trail system. The commercial land uses will link directly to the site's surroundings, which will be redeveloped as a commercial and industrial park. The framework for the Scoville site focuses on multiple site reuses, including a woodland, an environmental education area, a playground, and a senior housing complex. So just a note about these reuse framework strategies. What you'll notice is there may be some dashed lines indicating trails, but these aren't, they're not detailed site plans. They're not, they're certainly not ready to move into construction documents. They're at a much higher level, and the purpose of that is to retain that flexibility over time as the remedial process advances and new information is gathered, and perhaps even community goals or ownership changes. The framework's designed to be flexible in nature and sort of adapt to new information over time. Slide 32 outlines some post-charrette activities. Once the charrette has concluded, the project's reuse framework will have been finalized and presented to the community and EPA. In the third stage, project participants work together to finalize a long-term implementation plan for returning the site to reuse. Some of these post-charrette activities can include coordinating timelines, responsibilities, and key next steps, clarifying site ownership, acquisition, and stewardship strategies, addressing site stigma and liability considerations, and resolving information gaps and data issues. Slide 33 outlines some additional post-charrette tasks, which include informing local, state, and federal documents or decision processes, institutionalizing the reuse planning capacity locally, and identifying partnerships and resources for implementation. So I want to touch on what do we mean by reuse planning capacity. Once the charrette is complete, ultimately the site owner and local stakeholders are responsible for facilitating the reuse. Ideally, the charrette process should build the local support needed to implement reuse once EPA has completed the cleanup process. So ideally, the charrette is a time of building that local support, engaging the local stakeholders, and creating that capacity for implementation once the charrette is complete and the remedial process is underway. Slide 34 introduces Module 3, and I'll just note here that this is a quick module. It's just 5 slides, and then we'll have a break for discussion. So Module 3 reviews when to consider a charrette for a site in the remedial process. So I think this is starting to get at a question that was raised a bit earlier. Slide 35, when to use a charrette process. Design charrettes can be used at any stage of the cleanup cycle, as James had mentioned earlier. However, they might play a different role depending where they are on the charrette, and they may involve different stakeholders depending on where they are used in the cleanup process. Charrette strategies can also be revisited and updated based on new site and community information, as we talked about earlier. Often, site planning is an iterative process, and so it may be that conduct a charrette or a workshop in the remedy selection phase, and then a couple years later, 2 or 3 years later, there may be a follow-up charrette during the remedial design phase, and there may be new information to fold into that process. Design charrettes may be a helpful tool to consider using at contaminated sites under a number of different scenarios, and we'll just walk through a few of these. The first one, if EPA staff need to identify the site's anticipated future use to inform response actions, and it may not be easily determined from, readily available information. Or if there's a community group, government entity, or other parties that express a lot of interest in a site's cleanup and revitalization. So engaging them early on in the process to ensure that the remedial process supports to the extent possible these parties' goals for the site. Third, if you determine that a site's anticipated future use will require coordination with a number of parties, and this might be the case if there's no clear site owner, for example, and the local government needs to step in and play a stronger role, or there's multiple very active stakeholders, that it would be helpful if they came together around a more unified vision for the site. Slide 36 just outlines a couple more scenarios. In some cases, education and outreach are needed to build relationships between EPA, the community, and other site parties. Charrette can be an excellent tool for building relationships and, again, building that kind of shared vision of what the future use of the site will be once it's cleaned up. Another situation might be that there's a lot of contention in the community. And a lot of miscommunication and misunderstanding. So again, providing a forum where there can, really develop a shared understanding of the site status. What's the contamination? How will the remedy address that contamination? How will it be safe for future use? And often a charrette can be very, very helpful in getting everyone really, again, with a shared understanding of the site's potential. And finally, it's helpful if there are no roadblock issues that require resolution prior to future land use discussion. So an example might be if there's a, you know, kind of a recalcitrant site owner that is not interested in engaging the community, that probably wouldn't be a good situation to involve the larger community in a discussion about reuse when the site owner isn't willing to participate. And we could, during the question period, we can talk about a couple other examples of when it might not be appropriate. For example, if the cleanup's going to take 10 or more years, you know, it might be premature to kind of develop that reuse momentum too early on. Slide 37 starts to outline the role of the charrette in the remedial process. The timing of a charrette in the remedial process determines how remedy and reuse considerations inform each other. Prior to remedy selection, future land use considerations can inform EPA site activities, including the site assessment, development of remedial action objectives, and the selection and design of a site's remedy. Design charrettes provide a way to identify future land use considerations that can inform EPA site activities, as well as community decision-making and planning. These upstream interventions present a host of additional opportunities as well, building community relationships, resolving potential conflicts early on, establishing realistic stakeholder expectations for a site's future use, and exploring how future land use considerations may enable potential cost or time savings for a site cleanup. Once a site's remedy has been designed, the focus of design charrettes changes. In most cases, the characteristics of a site's remedy and the type of land uses that it can support are primary factors in identifying potential future land uses that may be located at the site. Charrettes during these downstream stages are also an effective tool for EPA community stakeholders. For EPA, these processes can help ensure the development of effective institutional controls and identify potential future site users willing to implement and enforce institutional controls. For communities, the certainty of the types of land uses that a site's remedy will support can provide developers and other interested parties with the information they need to be able to move forward with a project. So again, early in the remedy process, reuse planning can, you know, is more likely to inform the remedy process in terms of remedial action objectives, baseline risk assessment, remedy selection. Once you are at the remedy selection or the record of decision stage, then it starts to flip and the remedy process is more likely to inform the reuse. And then you're starting to look at what remedy components might be in place at the site over the long term, what kind of institutional controls can be expected, and then how can that, how can reuse work within those constraints. Slide 38 summarizes the charrette activities that we've discussed in the past couple modules and sort of looks at them within the remedial time frame here. Charrettes for, you know, conventional projects that we talked about a bit in the beginning of the webinar can start quickly and move from ideas to implementation within months, you know, like James mentioned, the condo down the street. But charrettes at contaminated lands, like Superfund sites, can take much, much longer to start and much longer to implement, just given the nature of the remedial process. But the long-term nature of many site cleanups can serve as an opportunity. These timeframes provide localities and other key parties with the time needed to address the site stigma and liability and other considerations to ensure successful site reuse and the long-term protection of human health and the environment. The long-term nature of site cleanups may also mean that portions of sites can be reused in the shorter term, leveraging the redevelopment of sites to certain levels in phases. And this is, you know, often we see sites divided up into operable units, and there may be cases where portions of the site are addressed through response actions, early response actions. And so reuse planning can help think through that phasing, which parts of a site might be safe for reuse sooner and still allow the remedial process to continue. So that's another benefit of thinking about reuse during the remedial process, is to kind of facilitate, particularly if the community is very active and engaged and eager to use part of the site, it can be helpful to think about phasing. So with that, I think we are at another discussion point. Anyone has any questions or comments regarding the last module?
Okay, thanks very much. We do have a couple of questions that have already been submitted online. If you are streaming audio, go right ahead and be sure your pop-up lockers have been disabled and click that question mark button that appears at the top of the slide to type up comments or questions. In the meantime, though, I'm going to start off with the phone line audience again. You can take yourself off of mute by either hitting unmute or hit the #6 button to unmute your lines, and feel free to ask a question directly to the instructors.
I'm Miranda. This is Tom Blue in Region 5.
Hey, Tom.
How you doing? Hey, I wanted to address that one slide that you had about roadblock issues. Sometimes these charrettes can help bring people together when we identify like a roadblocking issue, on brainstorming on how to get around it. So it's kind of good, because when you get everybody together and you say, okay, we've got an issue here that's going to stop the site from being used, people in the room seem to gather around, okay, how can we work around that? And so I know your slide said, you talked about roadblocked issues, but I was going to say sometimes these charrettes are good to have everybody kind of help you with moving around the roadblock, whereas if you didn't have that, you'd be like working on your own to try to alleviate the issue and all. And so I've just seen that happen before. And also just the idea of brainstorming and having everybody come together to think about one idea and to try to tackle an issue kind of brings people together too. So I think in our, Region 5, we've had a couple of sites where we had real bad community relations, and we had a couple of, charrettes put together with some communities. And, of course, the first couple of, minutes isn't all that nice, and sometimes people have to vent, depending on what they've got built up inside them. But once we got that out and got everybody on board, it seems like it helped the projects to move forward. And there was even, people in the audience that were part of our group that were upset with other people for disrupting the process. So it really helps out to get everybody together in a room to kind of work together towards a common goal like that, I think.
This is Melissa Friedland. I just wanted to back up Tom Bloom, who didn't tell you that he has a lot of experience in charrettes. He's one of the people on the list in one of the first slides about regional people who are actively involved in Superfund redevelopment. So Tom speaks from long-term and dedicated experience that this is a very useful tool. Thank you, Tom.
Mm-hmm. And anybody can call me if they want, to talk, that's for sure.
Yeah, thank you, Tom, for mm-hmm. mentioning that. And I agree. And, another consideration in just thinking about roadblock issues is that it's possible to sort of sequence your charrette discussions. And it may be that early on it makes sense to start with just the sponsor team, the folks that have direct decision-making responsibility for the site. And there may be certain issues that need to get ironed out, between EPA, the state, the site owner, local government, before bringing other parties to the table. But it is, it's amazing, having witnessed it, time and time again, how bringing folks around the table to talk about the future use of a site can really engage that collaborative problem solving, and what seemed like a logjam, before the charrette, suddenly there's some ideas and some folks that are willing to maybe get unstuck, if you will, and think about how to move the site forward. And just to add to that, I think particularly with contaminated sites, there can be this sort of community momentum around frustration with the past, and the impact of contamination on their community. And what we've seen, I think Tom has definitely, you know, you could probably speak to this as well, that starting to focus on the future use of the site and bringing community members around the table to think about the future use can really change the relationship between the remedial process and the community to one that's really kind of focusing on the future and has a much more positive outlook.
Yeah, and it's kind of like a learning process too, because I think the people in the room initially that have an issue with the remedial and the technical are like, why are we even talking about reuse when we can't get past this, you know, QAP issue or this data validation issue or so? And but then it's kind of like once you start to work with them and they kind of see there's a light at the end of the tunnel, some of these issues that were really holding things up don't just seem to be as important to them as much, or they can kind of figure out a way to compromise around them and all like that. So I know that's come up a couple of times. You have to be careful with false expectations, and you have to be careful with people realizing that the timing isn't quite right as far as when you're putting your brainstorming together and your information gathering together. But one thing that I always remind them is that once we have this together, you can always take it off the shelf and reapply it and work with it too. We've had sites where, you know, we've had a great conceptual plan together, but the remedial process wasn't going to be finished for the next 5 years or so. Well, 5 years later, when it was finished, they took that shelf off the plan, and they were ready to go with it, with a little bit of tweaking, but so that helps out too. And I'll shut up now.
This is Ellie Hale. Hi. Can I jump in with a question? You mentioned raised expectations, and that strikes me as a real possibility. This could be so useful for bringing people together around a vision, but if the vision can't be realized for one reason or another, how do you deal with the possibility of kind of the establishment of a vision that can't be funded or a vision that can't be constructed? Or
what it is, it's an educational process, because sometimes the people would say, okay, we like condos and swimming pools, but guess what? The market doesn't, you know, we can do a mini market analysis through part one of our framework designs. The market doesn't really command a swimming pools and condos. You've got a bunch of uncontaminated properties, but you've got five schools in the area, only one park or so like that. So sometimes by putting, you know, educating them to what we can do, what we can't do with a remedy, it kind of helps to bring their false expectations more together and realize that, well, yeah, condos and swimming pools would be nice, but we have other uncontaminated properties to put this on. Right now, the market isn't calling for condos and swimming pools. Maybe we can phase this into putting a park together or do something in the short term. And I think that kind of helps out by, you know, like I said, educating the people that are coming up with these expectations kind of brings them back together, and catching them before they're getting too carried away is a good way to do it, too.
Just to add on to that, I think it's important to make sure EPA has a strong presence in the Charette, and ideally that your Charette team has experience with Superfund sites. We've definitely seen situations where the community goes off and sort of independently generates a reuse plan for a site without engaging EPA or technical expertise that might understand the remedial constraints. And then, you know, then EPA has to come in and bear the bad news that may not be possible. So ideally, if the Charette is constructed, you know, with some good foresight and planning, one of the outcomes will be managing expectations, so that you're sort of aligning reuse possibilities with you know, the inevitable remedial constraints at the site. I think it's an important outcome that you have in mind going into the Charette planning.
Well, and Miranda mentioned too that designing reuse frameworks, one of these outcomes, to be sufficiently flexible so that you're not designing highly technical construction drawings, but rather you're coming up with fairly conceptual illustrations, provides a way to basically come back in the future. And if for some reason information changes, new contamination is identified, there needs to be a significant change to a site's remedy, you develop the framework in such a way that it can be adapted rather than needing to be simply started from scratch, I suppose. So the notion of being able to revisit over time is very important in the outcomes from a charrette.
Oh, great. In line with that, I've got a number of questions that have come in online. I'm going to go through for a few more minutes and start hitting the streaming simulcast questions. And there was one that was somewhat related to that came in from Arizona. And they ask, do you ever have to go back and explain to participants when the plans agreed upon by the charrette process are changed by agency decision makers due to budget constraints or other unforeseen circumstances? And how is that done without destroying the charrette credibility?
Okay, who wants to handle that one, James?
I think, I mean, that's ideally, I was just going to suggest that ideally, you know, there's an opportunity to re-engage the community, present the new information, and sort of rethink and troubleshoot how to adapt the reuse in a collective way. You know, I would say that's the ideal outcome. And I think I had mentioned that we were involved in a site that had a reuse plan generated that didn't factor in the remedial considerations. And so there was a process of going back to the community, reaffirming their reuse goals to start with, and then trying to look at the reuse, the future uses that they were hoping to obtain on the site and figuring out how they could be accommodated given the long-term remedial components. And that turned out to be a successful outcome, and the community was really pleased that they, you know, it may not have been the specific uses and the specific locations that they had originally developed, but they felt really happy that the uses they had identified could be accommodated in some way on the site. So usually there's some kind of modification that folks will understand if they're presented with the new information and can participate in some of that problem solving.
Also, by having the project managers as a source or a resource in the charrette, you know, sitting in the back that can answer questions, if it's kind of about managing expectations. I mean, if a decision is going to be made that project manager is going to have a hard time with later on, for example, the funding, you know, that would be a time where a project manager could say, well, you know, there's no way I can think I can get $30 million to, you know, remove this entire landfill. But, you know, going through the priority process and trying to get money to, you know, put a cover over it, that's probably where we're going to go with it. So sometimes through the charade process and by just, you know, information exchanging, we can manage these expectations so that if a decision's made, it's not way off base with which way we're going. Sometimes you have to be careful, too, because you haven't made the decision yet, and you don't want people to get too far ahead saying, well, you know, at this meeting you said that you may do this or you may do that. But that's why good documentation of these the frameworks kind of helped us to go back and say, well, we didn't say definitely this is going to happen. But I've had that before where, you know, just through talking to people, we realize that, you know, this decision is not going to be one that we can make in the future because it's going to be too costly or so like that to do a remedy. So we might have to change it in the future. Or at least having them, the people that are the stakeholders that are in the charrette, aware that some of these things are dynamic and they aren't set in stone, and to expect a change later on, that helps out also when the change does come or the decision changes later on.
Thank you very, very much. I appreciate all the input and the questions, and we do have a lot of them coming in. Don't worry, they are there. In the interest of time, I'm going to make 2 points and then I'll have us move along. First, you've had a couple comments, Tom, come in that people really appreciated your insight and your experience. So I just wanted to remind everybody that on slide number 8, we did list the points of contact across the EPA regions who are involved with this process. Tom, if you want to say your name and email address, you're welcome to share that as well if people want to follow up.
Sure. If it's not up there, it's bloom.thomas@epa.gov.
Great. Thank you so very much.
Mm-hmm. And I think my number might be on that slide. I'm not sure.
Excellent. And then again, you guys can always follow up with either myself or the instructors, and we'll get you in touch with anybody that you may have questions about in the particular regional offices. The other thing that I'm going to point out as we move along, again, if you do have questions, please feel free to type them up. Be sure to go ahead and submit them at any point in time. We have plenty of time this afternoon to keep going with questions as we move on with the materials. If we don't get to your question today, all of your information when you type them up is captured with your contact information. So we'll be sure to pass that on to the organizers and instructors, and I'm sure they'll be able to reach out to you and be able to follow up with an answer to your questions. So I just wanted to say thanks to everyone for the engagement. We do know it, so we will get an answer to you. With that, I'm going to ask everybody to please place your phone lines back on mute. Either use your own mute button or hit *6 to locally mute. I'm going to turn it back over to the instructors, moving everybody on to slide number 40 to carry on with the presentation.
Thank you, Jean. It's James here. I'll be taking over for this module. I did also want to point out we actually did have another fantastic resource on the line during the discussion. Melissa Friedland is EPA's National Program Manager for Superfund Redevelopment, and so I just wanted to mention that she's on today's call and that the Superfund Redevelopment Initiative is a very helpful and available resource for folks who are thinking about charrettes for contaminated lands. Okay, so moving on to webinar module number 4. The key question we're going to be talking about in this module is how can charrettes engage communities and lead to collaborative opportunities? Moving on to slide 41, there's really two primary reasons. One is the structure of charrettes themselves. They're conducive to collaborative problem solving and to resolving conflict. Charrettes openly recognize and address site complexities, include diverse interests and concerns, provide comprehensive information resources, and normalize conflict as part of process discussions. And secondly, conditions of contaminated lands are frankly ripe for collaborative opportunities. Parties may have different positions and very disparate perspectives, but they all have a shared interest in site cleanup and reuse outcomes. And this bottom line can lead to effective partnerships and initiatives among parties and sites. For the next slide, slide 42, I just wanted to touch base on conflict for a second as we think about what actually makes for effective charrettes from a collaborative problem-solving and conflict resolution perspective. Now, you can see there's a definition of conflict on the page here. Most people could probably boil conflict down to a lot less words, things like difficult, frustrating, painful, emotional, not where you want to be. But if you look at conflict through the lens of a charrette process, you can start to see conflict fairly differently. And I should say I'm not trying to simplify. Conflict is all of those adjectives I just mentioned that I would be the first to recognize. But through the lens of charrettes, you can also understand conflict as being natural, normal, inevitable, neutral, and lastly, as an opportunity. It's very important to recognize that conflict doesn't just happen, that its sources can be understood and addressed. And by doing so, conflict can help reveal injustices. It can attract attention to problems that need to be addressed. It can foster creativity, and it can empower individuals and groups to take control of their lives. So seen through the lens of a charrette, conflict is actually an opportunity for things like identifying problems, improving understanding, creating innovative solutions, improving relationships, improving standards and policies, engaging stakeholders, and building capacities. So as we look to slide 43, the question becomes, how can we design charrettes so that they most effectively serve as tools for collaborative problem solving and conflict resolution? And I'm going to walk through about 8 keys here. I'm just going to touch on them briefly, and then we're actually going to look at a case study from the Money Point Revitalization Project in Virginia. So just starting with number 1 on this slide, the importance of customizing your approach, goals, and milestones for a site so that you're developing participant-appropriate approaches for your charrette process. 2, the importance of developing joint criteria for success, making sure that one is setting attainable charrette goals and identifying future milestones is appropriate. 3, beginning collaboration as early as possible in a charrette process, making sure that you're bringing people face-to-face to build those relationships before you necessarily even begin to think about future use. 4, being inclusive, invite broad participation in the charrette process. So of course that means inviting those who are directly impacted. It also means those who are indirectly impacted. It means those who might support a charrette process as well as those who think it's the worst idea they've ever heard of. It also means bringing all the decision makers to the table and a contaminated land that can include site owners and potentially responsible parties. Slide 44. Some additional keys to think about. The importance of building in high-quality, credible information as part of your charrette process. High-quality information provides a way for people to meaningfully participate, to have the information they need to be able to provide informed responses as part of the charrette process. 6, focusing on interests rather than positions. Folks are probably very familiar with at Superfund sites. Clean that site up now. I want that site cleaned up to a pristine condition. Those would be examples of positions. But if you actually drill down behind those positions, you'll find that folks hold a very wide range of interests, ranging from ensuring the protection of human health through to thinking about the future and what they'd like their community to look like. So by focusing on interests, one can actually engage much more broadly with people than if you're dealing solely with positions. Seventh, separating people from the problem, making a clear distinction between the issue at hand and the fact that the people who are at the table are the people who need to work with you to help solve that problem. And then lastly, developing options for mutual gains, identifying feasible opportunities that are going to work for all key parties. All right, well, let's look at how these keys play out in an actual site project example. If we go to slide 45, we'll go in and talk a little bit about the Money Point Revitalization Task Force. This is a project that had a charrette built into its 18-month process, a very successful process, looked at cleaning up a very contaminated part of the Elizabeth River, with the goals being to sustain the local economy and also to restore the environment. Money Point is about a 35-acre area at a bend in the southern branch of the Elizabeth River in Chesapeake, Virginia. Once the area flourished with shipping terminals, factories, and wood treatment plants, and legend has it that the locals dubbed it Money Point for all the jobs and all the wealth it created. In recent years, however, laced with high concentrations of cancer-causing contaminants, Money Point was thought to be a biological dead zone, a lost cause. But in 2006, the Money Point Revitalization Task Force celebrated the completion of a 10-year plan to clean up and revitalize the area, and the charrette process was what led to the plan that it then published. To date, $6.5 million of cleanup work and restoration work is underway, and when completed, the project will be one of the largest environmental restoration projects in the Chesapeake Bay. Next slide. Just a bit of background about the process end. The project began with a situation assessment in spring of 2004 to actually interview stakeholders about their concerns and priorities. The task force itself began meeting in early 2005. The charrette process took place as part of those meetings, and then the project resulted in this final revitalization plan that is now guiding the cleanup, restoration, and reuse of the area. So if we move to slide 47, we can actually start looking at some of these keys in action. So collaboration key number two, developing joint criteria for success. Well, at Money Point, the task force developed a shared vision, which you can see in the slide here, and also developed a set of joint criteria for success. They said that any kind of cleanup, reuse, restoration plan had to meet with community-wide acceptance. Everyone had to agree that it would effectively protect human health and the environment, and everyone would have to agree that it helped lay the groundwork for a viable economy in the area in the future. Slide 48. They also set out a series of goals, which you can see on the left column here, ranging from cleaning up Money Point, the second goal there to actually prevent additional pollution from coming into Money Point, three, enhancing community quality of life, four, establishing environmental stewardship, and finally, creating an integrated network of habitat for wildlife. Slide 49. Turning to collaboration key number three, beginning collaboration as early as possible. Relationships were very, very important at Money Point, and I mentioned the situation assessment, that the outreach began at that point, interviewing more than 50 people, so that by the time the charrette process actually started, participants had built relationships, they knew each other, and they had established ground rules. I just want to emphasize the extent to which relationship building is a key part of the opening stages of planning for a charrette. On to slide 50. Speaking of providing high-quality, credible information, well, at Money Point, the task force contracted with independent technical expertise to review findings for the community, and scientists also served as members of the task force. And all task force meetings were conducted with frequent opportunities for questions and discussions. So during the charrette, when the charrette started, this meant that the task force could rely on the information that had been developed to then help them identify realistic scenarios for the area's revitalization, scenarios that integrated remedial and future land use considerations. On to slide 51, focusing on interests and not positions. I mentioned earlier how positions tend to be fairly narrow and they tend to be very difficult to work with. If you have a position, you're basically standing by it and marshaling evidence behind it, but there's no real outreach, there's no real looking to work with others or to come up with solutions. But if you're able to focus on interests, and charrettes are particularly good at this, by bringing people to the table and saying, hey, what are your underlying interests here? What would you like to see in the long term at Money Point? Folks there were able to move from their original position, which was, hey, get rid of all the contaminated sediments, to talking about their underlying interests, which in this case included, hey, we need to protect human health and safety. We We want to make sure the aquatic system's health is restored. We want to make sure that whatever is done here, that the cleanup is affordable, and that lastly, that the area, again, is economically viable in the future. How do we come together to address all of these much broader interests? Collaboration keys 7 and 8 are on slide 52. We talked briefly about separating people from the problem and developing options for mutual gains. So at Money Point, again, with the early relationship building, people on the task force were able to move from a position of pointing across the table and saying, they're the problem, that agency or that business or that person is the problem, to taking a step back and realizing that it's really all of our problem, that we're not going to get anywhere unless we're working together to address this. And then for the final example, developing options for mutual gains, everyone at the table in the task force really focused on improving quality of life for all stakeholders. So that meant everyone from residents to industry. So industry was at the table because they were seeking to regain use of a largely impaired waterfront for business purposes. And for residents, it was a case of saying, hey, we've been dealing with a lot of contamination for a long period of time, and we'd like to actually live in a community that looks like what we'd like it to look like. And then the third piece was the river's restoration and really focusing on ecological revitalization. Next slide. That brings us to outcomes for the project, for the Elizabeth River Project and the Money Point Revitalization Task Force. This slide highlights the community celebration that took place in October 2006. This was the meeting at which, or the celebration at which, the task force's final plan from the charrette process was shared publicly and publicized and finalized. U.S. Congressman Randy Forbes spoke at the event. There were about 150 people there. And in terms of the project's current status, the cleanup and restoration of Money Point began just over a year ago in July of 2009. Phase one of the cleanup is addressing about 20 acres of contamination, which includes removal of toxic hotspots, and then actually the placement of a living cap of clean sand and wetlands to restore healthy habitat. And in addition, the Elizabeth River Project is restoring about 6 acres of tidal wetlands and forest along the river. And it's doing so partly because a private company, the Elizabeth River Terminals, donated that land for the project. And phase two, which is expected to be finished by about 2012, is going to involve the cleanup of an additional 12 acres and restoration of those acres and the excavation of about 80,000 cubic yards of contaminated sediment. And I know we've got a lot of interest in resources, so just to list some of the resources that were brought to bear on this project. Most of the resources were provided by the Living River Restoration Trust, which is a mitigation fund authorized by the Corps of Engineers and the Department of Environmental Quality. Support also came from EPA's Targeted Watershed Initiative and Community Action for a Renewed Environment Program, NOAA's Community-Based Habitat Restoration Program, the Virginia Department of Environmental Quality, the Fish America Foundation, the Virginia Migratory Waterfowl Stamp Grant Program, the Hess Corporation, the Luckstone Corporation, and also the members and donors of the Elizabeth River Project. If we turn to slide 54. This just one of the graphic illustrations from the task force final plan. Again, one of the outcomes, visualizing the outcomes from the charrette process. So you can see Money Point here, and just basically outlining the enhancements that are a key part of that plan, which includes stormwater management, wildlife habitat, areas for improved community quality of life, and basically trying to, again, bring these pieces into this existing area to coexist and help enhance both the existing industries that are there as well as the neighborhoods that are there. I don't think we have a discussion placeholder slide at the end of this module, but we have reached the end of module 4. So Gina, if we pause here, would that work?
Sure, absolutely. So again, we're stopping on slide number 55. Before we get into the resources, we do have a few questions specifically about that, but I'm going to hold those off and really kind of focus on some of the other ones that have come in more specific about the charrette and the charrette process. And this is a reminder, I'm going to start with the online questions right now, but again, if you are on the phone lines, in a second we'll switch over to you and we'll allow you to take yourselves off of mute to ask a question. I'm going to start with a question that comes in there's a general question that asks if you see the charrette process used more frequently at Superfund sites versus brownfield sites.
That's hard to say. I think, we've been more involved in the Superfund sites through the Superfund Redevelopment Initiative, but I'm imagining that there are many workshops at brownfield sites as well. I think, one of the potentially big differences between the two is just the length of time, involved in the remedial process at Superfund sites and, leveraging that to the advantage as much as possible, as well as managing the expectations about when the site might be available for reuse.
Okay, great. Thank you. The next question comes in from Austin, Texas, and they ask, what are the keys for using a charrette for conflict resolution when there are stark disagreements on site reuse or other issues?
A couple of thoughts on that. One I would say is absolute honesty about airing those disagreements as part of a charrette process. So, again, part of that is making sure everyone's at the table so that, it may seem strange sometimes to say that you might bring to your table your greatest enemy to work on a project, but if they're not at the table with you, it's likely they're outside the room trying to undermine what you're doing. So trying to bring them into the umbrella, bring them into the process so that they're actually contributing, and trying to work on the problem with you instead of just creating additional problems. It's a case of working together to say, hey, this is our problem. How do we actually, how do we deal with this situation? Other thoughts, Miranda?
Okay. I have another question that came in online from Boston, and they ask, in EPA's experience using charrettes at Superfund sites, do you have any observations about whether charrettes are most commonly or most effectively used at a particular phase of the remedial process, for example, pre, post, or mid-remedy selection?
Was that a question specific for EPA reuse coordinators?
Yeah, I
This is Bill. Do you want to take that one, or do you want me to take that one?
I mean, I was just going to say, this is Melissa, that I think in a perfect world, everyone would sit down at the very beginning of the process and say, how are we going to do this? What is to be done? What issues do we have? What are our visions? But that never happens. There's real life. And so I would say that that if you have a charrette, it can be very, very helpful. And that while we would like to say this is exactly when it would occur, we can't do that. We generally work on charrettes when we're asked, and sometimes to be asked to put together a charrette means that people have been working on the site for a long time and they somehow get to that place. So it's kind of hard to tell. I guess I would think that you have to be fairly organized in some way to kind of figure out that you would like to have a charrette and then get the infrastructure in place to do that. So I would say that charrettes tend to happen later as opposed to earlier, but that doesn't mean that they're not valuable if they happen earlier, and that, we would prefer that everybody sort of sat down at day one and started talking, but we don't usually see that.
And, Melissa, the purpose of the charrette, depending on when it's going to be implemented, is kind of different. If we're putting one together because we're trying to figure out reasonably anticipated future land use and we're brainstorming with everybody there, that's one thing. They don't know what they want to do with it. But if, let's say, it's post-construction completion and there's an issue we're trying to work around, then that's the forefront, where our objective is to figure out what can we do to work around this issue that's, stopping the site from being put into reuse. So it's a little bit different as far as the objective of the charrettes, depending on what time of what the phasing of the site is at that time.
Thanks. I'm going to move on with just a few more questions online, and then we'll go over to the phone lines. This is somewhat related. This question comes in from Boston, Massachusetts, and they're asking if charrettes have been used to obtain input into cleanup issues. Have they been used in a natural environment, for example, sediment or wetland site, to inform remediation or restoration? And if so, how have they worked?
We have the Kalamazoo River is a sediment site.
Yeah, and so also, Amanda, we're just talking about Elizabeth River in terms
mm-hmm,
of.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so I guess the simple answer would be yes.
They have been used.
Yeah.
The issues are just different, and you have to identify those issues and educate people to what you can and what you can't do with the sediments.
There's another example in Region 8 I'm familiar with, too, which is the Milltown Reservoir sediment site. They used a charette process out there for the Clark Fork River before, taking out a dam and then diverting the Clark Fork River to restore the floodplain. And then I think it's this fall they're scheduled to actually return the Clark Fork River to its original riverbed. So there's actually going to be an SRI case study coming out on that sometime this fall as well. So there'll be that resource as well.
Great. Someone asked the question, what is the role of the PRP in a charette?
James, you want to talk about that, or you want me to do it?
Was that you, Anna?
That was Melissa, James.
No, it was Melissa. I was just going to say, do you want to answer that based on your experiences?
I'd be happy to follow you, Melissa, if you'd like to start.
Well, I mean, I would just say generally that the PRP is a stakeholder, and it's very important that they're involved in the discussion about what goes on at the site. I think it would be very hard to have a site without the PRP. Now, the PRP isn't always willing to come, and maybe sometimes they join later. But I would say you have to look at them at first as a stakeholder, like everybody else, and you want to be inclusive with your stakeholders.
Yes, and I would emphasize, too, that, one would typically anticipate that a responsible party would not be necessarily that excited about the prospect of a reuse planning process, would ask a lot of questions about what its purpose was, with the underlying concern being, hey, is this going to result in a much more expensive cleanup, for example? There's, some very well-founded concerns they might have, but a key part of the charrette process is education for everyone, and just like establishing realistic community expectations for a site's future use is helpful for communities and EPA, it's also helpful for responsible parties as well, and that they recognize they're actually entering into a process where they can trust the people they're working with, and they're all working together in good faith to come up with solutions that are going to work on multiple fronts. So the way Melissa mentioned it, that they may join later, is something we do often see, that you may meet initial resistance, but then usually at some point it makes more sense to be on the outside, more sense to be on the inside than on the outside. So it may take some time, but RPs, responsible parties, often do join, maybe not at the beginning, but certainly in the early stages.
James, this is Bill Denman. I'm the Region 4 SRI coordinator. I would also add that it probably also depends on whether the PRP is the property owner or not, as and that determines what their perspective is, whether they're working with the community to help find a future use that they want to implement, but that's also acceptable to the community. Whereas if the PRP is not the property owner, then they have a different perspective.
Good point.
Thank you, Bill.
Okay, I'm going to squeeze in one more question online and then switch it over quickly to the phone. This is a simple question that came in also from Boston, and they'd like to know if participants are typically invited to a charrette meeting, or are these sessions open for anyone to attend?
Brenda, I've seen both situations, but I think what I've found to be more effective is if there's some really there's a lot of thought put into the participants that need to be at the table, and actively reaching out to those folks and encouraging them to participate. And sometimes I've seen what's worked really well is to have, say you have like a two-day charrette process. At the end of that process, you have a larger community meeting to present what came out of the charrette process. I've seen it work both ways. I think the key is really that you definitely want to make sure you have your tier one stakeholders present, and do what you can to make sure you've got that participation. And then if there's an opportunity either during the entire charrette or you make time for a special presentation to the broader community, that's helpful as well.
Great, thank you. Real quick, if anybody is on the phone, you're welcome to take yourself off of mute and ask a question. You can use the pound six on mute.
This is Sharon Fry. I'm calling in from EPA headquarters in the water program under Clean Water Act. And I'm wondering if it's harder. We were just talking about this case study that had to do a lot with waterfront activities. And what I'm wondering is it harder and more complicated to address issues that combine water and land use, for example, NPDES permits or wetlands regs or water quality standards, those kinds of things, than it is to work on only the land use issues.
This is Miranda. I actually think there's a lot of parallels to the water quality issues and remedial issues, and I say that because my background was in water quality, working in the state of Washington and the city of Seattle. And we actually used the charrette process a number of times around water quality issues, and specifically around redevelopment projects where there was an interest in achieving very high flow and water quality standards post-development. And so it was pretty important to bring together the state and federal folks and the folks from the local government. And it's similar because some of the similarities I see is the regulatory context, and then you have the very technical issues in terms of contaminants, what's known as well as what might be uncertain. And then you're trying to work out reuse scenarios that might achieve certain goals in terms of health for the environment. So I think it can work very well. And in fact, there's a site being looked at through the Superfund Redevelopment Initiative up in Philadelphia that's part of the Lower Darby Creek watershed draining to the Chesapeake Bay. So there's an example of a site that's looking at both remedial issues, but it's a significant part of the Chesapeake Bay watershed. And so it's a good candidate for a charrette.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that. Just again, in the interest of time, I'm going to stop the question period now, but we'll be able to stay on the line a little bit after our scheduled end time to continue with the dialogue. So with that, I'm going to ask everybody, please go back onto mute, hit the star 6 button, or mute your line. And I'm going to turn things back over to our instructors on slide number 55. And actually, I think from there, I will take it. This is Anna Abbey back from CPRC. First, I'm going to talk about a couple of resources in terms of extended trainings and more information you can get on the charrette process, and then we'll go into what I know everyone's super interested in, is how on earth would you actually pay for this process, and is it actually implementable because of that? But first, training workshops. CPRC is currently sponsoring a one-day course that's an extended version, more in-depth, more interactive, live and in-person, that we can send out to regions should they request it. Well, the region will have to select the date, provide the room, and do some publicity. We need at least 15 people in the room, but it can include state and local. We, of course, are aiming this at EPA staff, so the preference is to have a majority of the people in the room be EPA. And that is available on request, fully funded. Now, there's also, of course, some online materials. We'll send out further links that give further resources and information, including links to the Superfund Redevelopment Initiative website and a resource list for further contacts if the names on slide 8 are not enough to get you where you need to go. And then also all the webinar materials will be available still on Cluin after this is over. Next slide, slide 57. The slide here is talking about CPRC-specific funding, but I'd like to take the opportunity at this time to ask Melissa Friedland to talk about the Superfund Redevelopment Initiative and what resources they have available before I go into that.
Sure. Thank you. Superfund Redevelopment has contracting available for Superfund-specific activity. So we have an in-kind services contractor, in fact, which is E-Squared, people who've been talking to you today, and we'd be very happy to talk to you about Superfund site activity, and what we ask is that you go through the list of names that was on the front slide, because those are our regional contacts, and we can work through them to try to bring training out and see what kind of site specific activity you need to encourage reuse and to make sites bring them closer to reuse, make them available. So I would work through for Superfund sites. I would work through the Superfund Redevelopment Initiative coordinators.
Great, thank you. In terms of CPRC, we also have money available for Superfund specific sites that can be used in addition to the resources available for the Superfund redevelopment initiative. Especially looking at the initial process of the situation assessment, where you really bring the community together to assess whether the project, how the project is going to shape up. But also, we have people in our office that are available to consult with you, discuss with you the options for a charrette, provide you with more information, and if it's not a Superfund site or something outside of the norm of what we can offer direct funding for, we can work with you to try to find funding and see if we can do a kind of compilation of funding sources, as in the example for the Elizabeth River. Yeah, that's about it for that. And I think the next slide really just goes into some contact information. I'm the lead on this at the CPRC along with Deborah Dalton. Our phone numbers and contact information are there, as well as, of course, you should get involved with your Superfund Redevelopment Initiative coordinators out in the region. And there are some other trainings available through CPRC that might benefit you. If you go to the next slide on 59, including quest for consensus, using a mediator to maximize effectiveness in a negotiation, situation assessments, interest-based negotiation, and apology as a conflict prevention tool. Are there any questions right now that wouldn't be specific to your region or site that deal with resources?
Again, if you're on the phone lines, you can take yourself off of mute by hitting pound six. Okay. Did you want to go through some of the questions that had come through about funding, or do you want to take a break here?
Well, there is. Would you read that one out loud?
Sure, absolutely. We do have a question. We do recognize a number of you were asking. We were just holding to kind of group some of the financial questions towards the end. I apologize for holding you in the queue. But a question came in that asked, how strongly is EPA favoring using Brownfield's assessment grant money for charrettes, especially given that the cost may be $70,000 to $100,000? Please elaborate. Will a municipality be more likely to win a grant if their proposal includes a charrette?
And I welcome any kind of input from anyone else on the line, but I would have to say from our vantage point here, I don't know. But I can look into that for you and see if there's a contact in the Brownfield's office that would have that information, and we can follow up with that information once we do receive it.
Yeah, I have a little bit on that because, you know, through the Brownfield's grants, the people that get the grants are supposed to do public participation. So we're granting them money to kind of do this now. How they do that and what they, you know, whether they could go and put a charrette on together or hire E-Squared to do it, I don't know. But, you know, whereas in Superfund, we're supposed to, you know, the RPMs are supposed to do the community involvement and put on the active public participation portion of it. In Brownfields, we're granting money to the grantee to do that. So it's up to them, and they have to do that in accordance with the terms and conditions of the grant. That's about what I know about it.
Okay, great. Any other questions on the phone line? I know we've run just a little bit past our scheduled end time. I think we're just going to take a few more minutes, and then we'll formally close things out. We've got a number of questions that did come in online. Any of those that we're not able to address live in the session, our presenters and instructors will follow up. Some of them are pretty specific about funding options. So the organizers and presenters today will follow up with you if you did submit a question electronically online that we haven't addressed right now. So with that, I'm going to ask that everybody move on to today's final slide, which is slide number 60, and we'll be able to officially close out today's session. But first, I want to be sure to thank all of our instructors, our organizers, and our attendees for joining us today for the information session on the charrette, and I hope that you found this to be a useful expenditure of your time. On slide number 60, I'm going to point you to two important resources that I mentioned earlier today. The first is the additional resources page, which is also hyperlinked on the seminar homepage when you first registered for today's session. And on that additional resources page, not only can you download today's slides, but you can also look at a collection of other resources related to this presentation. The second link, which is very important, and I would stress that everybody take a look at this, is the feedback form. If you follow that link, you can also get to it from the seminar homepage at any time. It's a short information session feedback form that the organizers would like for you to fill out to help ensure they continue to deliver online sessions like this. If you are sharing the line with multiple participants, there is an option once you submit feedback, the next person can click on a link to submit their own feedback. So each person can submit feedback for the session. Also, if you're looking for credit for your participation today, if you're keeping credit or training records for either CEUs or PDHs, if you fill out feedback individually, each one of you will be given the option to check a box to have a confirmation email sent to you to keep for your records. So again, if you want credit for today's session, I highly recommend you take a moment to fill out that feedback form. And you again can get to the feedback form link at the bottom of the seminar homepage as well. So I'm going to close things out again and thank everybody for their participation today. A reminder that this session was recorded. If you are interested in attending future CLUIN seminars, you're welcome to browse the public listing of CLUIN training at cluin.org/training. And in particular, those of you who have questions on brownfield funding opportunities may be interested in some upcoming brownfield seminars we have planned on CLUIN in the next month or so. So again, thank you all for your time and your questions. I hope you found this to be a useful session and that we'll see you or hear from you all on a future CLUIN Internet seminar. Thank you all and have a great day.